funziona. It's ok, va bene così. Sì.
So, what to talk about? One more reminder.
Can help us be healthy, well adjusted, integrated, and non-toxic in our Krishna consciousness.
Yeah. Well, wait. Thank you. First, what immediately comes to mind is that by definition, Krishna consciousness has to be non-toxic.
Yeah, it's supposed to be.
No, because if I have toxic Krishna consciousness, that's an oxymoron. One word is killing each other. No? So, by definition, Krishna consciousness must be not only non-toxic for so much positive content, but sometimes we may need to start speaking with what Krishna consciousness is not. We may need to say it's not toxic, among many other don'ts. but yeah, I think it's important for us to make the own practice our lifestyle, because for me the ideal thing is that our practice and our life are not two separate projects. My sadhana becomes my life becomes my sadhana, and I don't live in a binary. I don't have two different lives, so to say, some type of bipolar disorder in bhakti. In the beginning, we may start a little bit with this dualistic orientation. My practice, my sadhana, and then my material life, my spiritual life. But eventually we realize that it's all one project. And that's what makes the whole thing for me sustainable. So healthy Krishna consciousness must be sustainable. Sometimes we describe ourselves as Vaishnavas. Vaishnava, word Vaishnava comes from Vishnu, those who adore Vishnu. And Vishnu, if we analyze Vishnu in connection with Brahma and Shiva and the classic Trinity, in that sense, Vishnu is, I like to say, the God of sustainability. No? Vishnu is the maintainer. No? So it's the one who sustains, who maintains, so the God of sustainability. So if we are Vaishnavas, we are worshipping the God of sustainability, we have to make our practice sustainable. If not, it will be a dishonor to our Ishtadev, so to say. So that's for me a very interesting idea to think, okay, my Thakurji, my worshipable Prabhu, is the God of sustainability. So how to conduct my adoration in a way that reflects the object of my affection? If I'm sending my affection toward the embodiment of sustainability, how much that should be reflected back, and how do I conduct myself in the daily life? So I always like to thing that, or I like to tell devotees, and by doing that tell that to myself, that we want to practice, we want to be devotees for eternity, right? So we don't want to be practicing for one weekend, a few years, like be like a flashing light for 3 years and then disappear. That happens, you know, these flashing lights that appear, shine, and disappear. So we want to make the whole thing sustainable till eternity, right? So that takes a very balanced approach. How do I remain practicing this with faith, with enthusiasm, with growing in a sustainable way? And sometimes that's complicated, because we may tend to go a little bit too much to the extremes of the pendulum. Sometimes we are prevented. Be careful not being lazy, not being like evasive. You have to do some things, but sometimes we may go to the extreme of the burnout in the name of dedication, and it may, okay, there may be some emergency necessity of the moment, we over dedicate, so to say, our faculties, but we know we couldn't sustain that emergency moment on a daily basis. So how to know when it's an emergency, and when, how to take care that the emergency doesn't become the rule. Because if not, we live in a state of emergency. And sometimes that can be very, that can be a form of violence even to our nervous system and to our body. And that's, I will say, that's not bhakti. Sanatana Goswami, of course, not to compare ourselves with that, but just as a point of reference, Sanatana Goswami at one point wanted to kill himself. When his body got these sores and he got sick, Mahaprabhu was embracing him despite of the bodily impurities, so to say. Mahaprabhu will go embrace him, and for Sanatana Goswami, it's unbearable to think Mahaprabhu was carrying all this blood and pus and things coming from my source, and he's touching me every moment. So he thought in a very particular mood, I will leave this body. Mahaprabhu knew about that, and he said, who told you that's your body? Right? To begin with, right? Why you are thinking in terms of your body? No? That's for me, and through that body I have many ideas in mind that I will do through that. So in other words, take care of your body, because it's not yours at the end of the day. No? At the end of the day, we will say the body is, in our case, as sadhakas, we're practitioners, we have a sadhaka deha. Well, like Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, Siva sadhaka rupena, Siddha rupena chatraya. So we are to serve in sadhaka rupa, in sadhaka. So our body, technically speaking, is no longer a material body. It's a body in the process of transmutation towards spiritual body. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur speaks about that in the commentary of the Bhagavatam. He says, sadhaka is no longer a conditioned, a bada jiva, a conditioned soul, technically. It is not still a siddha, no? A perfected being. It's a work in process. But therefore the body that we could see, we could consider material, is a body in the process of full spiritualization, but bhakti's descent. So in one sense, we have to honor this body because it's not ours, because it's being imbued with bhakti. So we have to take care of it. That's my point, and that's part of me, what it means to make the bhakti project sustainable. In all the dimensions, physically, mentally, psychologically, emotionally, of course, spiritually. Spirituality is the core of it, but all the other dimensions should be included. That's kind of the, for me, the intention of Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita when he says, speaking about Bhakti 9.2, Bhagavad Gita, he is saying, Susukam Kartum. All this process has to be practiced with a lot of joy. I mean, you have to have some mental health, some balance to have some joy, some sattva, even if we want to use that word, sattva. It's not the goal of life, but I like to say it's kind of like a preliminary foundation to have a healthy approach to the goal of life, to practice bhakti for the right reasons. Because we can sometimes practice spirituality for not the best reasons, out of evasiveness, cape, unresolved thing, and we are having projections and idealizing. But when sattva is there, there is a balance and a clarity of view, and we can pursue bhakti for the actual right reasons. And one of the symptoms of sattva, Krishna says in the Gita, is happiness. It's a sense of content. Not content to, like, I stay here forever, but some sense of content that from that foundation I can make the quantum leap to transcendence, as I like to think in terms of, if I want to fly, I want to fly from here, Rome, we are in Rome here today. If I want to fly to Zurich, like I will have to in a few weeks, I will be in La Berna or whatever. It's not like, okay, I expect the plane to land at my door. No, I need to make the effort to go to the airport. I haven't been to Zurich yet, but that's the preliminary part that I have to, for me to be able to fly above the sky. So in the same way, in general, of course, bhakti is independent. But at the same time, in general, for me to take advantage of bhakti's independence and gifts, I may need to do the work of getting to the airport to take the bhakti plane. And that means kind of sattva, trying to do the work of being a balanced human being I'm trying to do everything balanced. Yukta, the word in Sanskrit for that is yukta. Krishna in the Gita, in the sixth chapter, he's saying yukta hara viharasya yukta chistasya karmasya yukta swapna bhavodasya. The word yukta comes like when he's speaking about the yogi, when of course at the end of the day he says the highest yogi is the bhakta, so it's for the devotee also that verse. See, yogi has to be balanced in his eating, in his sleeping, in what he's doing or she's doing during the day, what he or she's doing during the night, like implying all in between the spaces, balanced in everything. And balanced doesn't mean the same for everyone, right? What's balance? What's middle point for you and me? Maybe very different. Or it may be they're very different for me from today to tomorrow or to the next day. So balance also is like, for me, it's an ongoing daily recalibration. Okay, what's the balance I need today, now? Tomorrow may be different. You know, like the first two angas of Sharanagati, for me also speak about that. If you play out the implications of that. Anukulyasa sankalpa prati kulyasa varjanam. Accept what's favorable in Krishna's service, reject what's unfavorable. So that's not a fixed list of do's and don'ts, but accept what's favorable for you at this moment and reject what's not favorable for you at this moment. Maybe at other moment what's favorable pass to the other side of the list and vice versa. So that's a daily invitation for swadhyaya, no? For introspection, basically. What's good for me now? What's good for me? If I look to me like 25 years ago, or whatever, any other age, yeah, certain things that were favorable at that time are not favorable. Like we were talking the other day about, in the beginning, one may have, for example, a more dualistic idea, or more like black and white thinking, and okay, give me the formula how to be a devotee, what to do, what not to do. Okay, I have all the answers to all the questions. Okay, I'm in. And then after a few years, you realize, oh, maybe not after a few years, even after a few days, you start to realize that things are more nuanced than what I thought. You know? Between black and white, oh, there was gray. There are 256 shades of gray. And like someone told me the other day, and on top of that, Maharaj, there are different shades of black and white as well. So reality is very much nuanced than the original black and white that we already had. But in the beginning, we needed that kindergarten mentality. We cannot take much more. It's like a two-year-old baby. You cannot just like, let's talk about epistemology. And the baby will look at me like, bring the pacifier or a car or something. Eventually, we'll talk about more technical things. So also to have compassion for those who are in a more simplified situation, but all of us need to find a balance. What's balancing for me today? What's healthy for me today? And for me, this is also very, very interesting because, again, it's an ongoing rediscovery. How to practice Krishna consciousness in a balanced way. There is no one and final answer. I cannot just tell you, do this, like this, do that, like that, do not look that, and one size fits all. That's, I like to call that impersonalism. That's not personal. That's not suited and tailored to each one's case. For some person, this is required. For some other person, this is required. For Raghunath Das Goswami, it was okay to sleep 2 hours and a half per day when he slept at all. But for many of us, if we try to do that, right? So, and this is an interesting thing, right? Because, for example, sometimes we hear about sleep being tamasic. Sometimes we hear, okay, sleeping has to do with tamas is ignorance, let's avoid it. So the less you sleep, the better. But again, if you play out that rule to the fullest, you start to become quite tamasic because of not sleeping during the day. I don't want to cross you if you haven't slept enough. So paradoxically, if you bring enough tamas during the night, then you bring sattvas during the day. You are a more balanced human being because you have slept properly. follow my path.
We know what we are talking about, because kapha constitution.
Mm-hmm.
We had to need a little nap.
So all that is part of the self knowledge we need. What's good for you may not be good for the other, but it's not that one is better than the other or this one sleeps less. Sometimes we have this like negative orientation toward bhakti, so it's all about doing less. So the one who sleeps less and eats less is best, and probably not necessarily I've seen many of those trying to champion tapasya, and we get a very like ascetic approach to bhakti, and it becomes more tapasya, mukti oriented and eating less, and bhakti is not that. Right? Bhakti is, as Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada says, it's not fasting, it's feasting. Right? Of course, not as an excuse to overindulge in anything, but it's a positive process of love and so many beautiful things. So, and that's why Rupa Goswami, when he had to speak about vairagya, which can be it's a beautiful word, but it can be a dangerous one, like any other word if we don't just know how to approach it. He quickly qualified, I say, yukta vairagya. Yukta again, yukta hara vihara. Yukta means proper, balanced. Vairagya means detachment, renunciation. So detachment has to be balanced. If you go too much to one extreme or to the other, it's not healthy. And interestingly, when he defines what's yukta vairagya, because we say, okay, what's renunciation for us? Anasaktasya visayam yathartham upayunjata nirbandha krishna sambandhi yuktam vairagya mucchate. He says, yukta vairagya means to renounce the vision of things. I'm making it too complicated. He says, when you see everything in connection to Krishna, that's proper vision. And what do we have to renounce? To not see everything in connection to Krishna. That's yukta vairagya. He doesn't say vairagya means eating less, taking sannyas, being celibate. He says the thing we try to renounce is this self-centeredness. No? Like seeing things in... I was listening today in the morning to one... almost every morning I listen to some lecture from Srila Bhakti Kaitiyada Goswami Maharaj. He was talking about separate interest. How that's like basically the crux disease, no? Separate interest and seeing things disconnected from each other, separate, isolated. And Krishna Sambandha means seeing everything in connection to Krishna. So the only thing we are to renounce is seeing things without the proper center. That's it. He doesn't elaborate on you have to sleep less and eat less and be a monk and that can happen, may not happen, but as long as we keep the center in mind. So that's what makes me for a balanced practice of Krishna Bhakti, to make it sustainable today. I always like to think, okay, bhakti, we practice bhakti, bhaktiya sanjataya bhaktiya, says the Bhagavatam. Bhakti comes from bhakti, and bhakti takes to bhakti. Bhakti comes from bhakti. Bhakti, the goal of bhakti is bhakti. Whether sadhana, bhava, prem, but it's all, the word bhakti is always there. So we are not doing bhakti for something else, because there is something else, that something else will be higher than bhakti. For us, bhakti is the all in all, so it has to be its own goal. So we are already doing bhakti. So if bhakti is the goal of bhakti, I want to do bhakti forever, and I'm already doing bhakti, we are already doing what we want to do for eternity. So for me, that also brings lots of balance. I stop becoming like obsessed with like, I have to attain that goal, I have to get there. I'm brings us more like to the present moment. I'm already doing what I want to do forever. And there are many reasons to celebrate that. And of course, bhakti keeps growing without end. That's another point. There is no end point to bhakti. Even if you officially reach Golok Vrindavan, still bhakti keeps blooming. So that makes for me something to help. It helps me at least personally not to become so much goal-oriented, in bhakti, but presence oriented. Like here, now, how can I offer myself in bhakti? Thank you. Thank you. So that's something very important for me, because I've seen many times practitioners becoming too unaware of all the gift that they already have, not like all the grace that is coming, the chance to be doing what we can do. Someone asks Srila Bhaktivedanta Goswami Maharaj once, like, if I start practicing bhakti in this lifetime, how many lifetimes will it take for me to reach Golok Vrindavan? And he was kind of like amused with the question. Like, he never thought about that, in the sense that, why you're even thinking about that, right? And he, many times he, people ask him the question, but one of his replies was like, what's the rush? If the process is so enjoyable, like, basically, where do you want to go? No? If bhakti is so great and beautiful, why you are thinking about getting somewhere else? And the somewhere else that you need to get, you will only get if you are fully appreciating what you have in the here and now. Because if I'm practicing here without fully appreciating all that is coming, I won't get there, so to say, if I'm not there here. For me, that makes for very balanced orientation, in the sense that we are in the present moment, not so much like making all about the future and making also Krishna a distant person about the future, something, the goal, something that will come at some point, but not now, and we lose sight of so much that is coming already. Mm-hmm. The other day we were talking with Vaishnav, he's a disciple of Srila Bhakti Balatirtha Maharaj. We were talking about Bhakti Vigyan Bharati Maharaj. They are disciples of Bhakti Daita Madhav Maharaj. Uh-huh. And Bhakti Srila Bharati Maharaj will many times say this idea. Sometimes they would say, Kripa Koro, Kripa Koro, Kripa Koro. Like, give me mercy, be merciful to me. And we are not against that. But sometimes we were talking about that yesterday also. We can become like addicted to ask for mercy without realizing how much mercy is already there. So if you look at mercy, mercy is there. Already there is already mercy to begin with. So the real question is what I'm doing, how I'm honoring that mercy, rather than like more, more, more. So in the same way, sometimes we may become too obsessed with, still I'm lacking this in the future, this has to happen, give me more mercy, but we lose sight of what's here and now in the present moment. So that makes for me a very balanced Krishna consciousness to try to, Srila Siddha Maharaj will say many times, perfection is everywhere. Again, it's a nice quote, then we have to realize it, but in principle at least, to know that whatever I need, it's already here now. I don't need to go anywhere. It's not a future tense happening. It's everything's already taking place in the immediacy. I'm the only one who is not there, so to say. Krishna is omnipresent, I like to say, but many times we cannot perceive someone who is omnipresent, which means we are omni-absent. So maybe our practice is more trying to bring some presence to what is already there, to so much mercy and grace. So that's for me another way of speaking about a balanced Krishna consciousness. And I mean, there's so much to say about non-toxic Krishna consciousness. In one sense, everything we should be talking about is about that. For me, anarthani vritti, I don't want to get too long, but just one more thing that comes to mind, this idea of anarthani vritti. I like to, last year we did a retreat in Austria, and we called anarthani vritti, how we translate anarthani vritti, something like deconstructing false values. Because anartha means false value. Srila Siddha Maharaj will explain anartha's false value. Sometimes I like to say false beliefs. the false ideas we entertain. So a balanced practice sometimes implies unlearning some toxic ideas about Krishna, about ourselves, about everyone else, that we may have learned in a community. Maybe we brought them from childhood and unresolved stuff at home, and we filter that with through the Krishna conscious lingo, depending the case. As we were talking the other day, some may come and think, okay, Krishna doesn't love me, so I need to really work hard to earn God's love and to deserve grace. But grace cannot be deserved, because if not, if you start to talk about deserving, you're already in the karma department, not cause and effect. So grace is undeservable, it's too much to be deserved. So sometimes we may practice from that place of, I'm not, it's never enough. Like, it's never enough what I can do, it's never enough, and in a negative sense. Of course, there's a nice place of, I can always love more, can always save more, it's beautiful. But if it's from, I can say the same thing from a negative place. Like, it's never enough, I'm never enough. And you can really push yourself down, and that's not healthy. No? So for me, a balanced practice is also to get rid of toxic ideas about, I don't know, about God. God doesn't love you still. You need to learn to love God, and then only then God loves you back. That's not true. You should already love in advance. And our practice should be to love him back. Not that first I need to impress Krishna with my prem bhakti, and then only then he will, like, okay, let's see. No, that's not Karuna Sindhu, that's not an ocean of mercy, that's a very elitistic, exclusivistic idea of the divine. And I will say also that we need to have a healthy dose of self-compassion and self-acceptance. Because as we were talking the other day, Krishna Bhagavad Gita said the soul is amazing. So, as weird as it sounds, but we are amazing. We are the soul is amazing. Conclusion, if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, A is equal to C. Soul is amazing, I am a soul, I am amazing. Can you say that without cringing? Quickly, you can add a footnote to clarify, but I'm not my own creation. So I have no reason to become proud. It's not like a narcissistic, arrogant thing. And on top of that, it's not only that you are amazing, but everyone else is as well, because everyone else is also Atman. But there is a place to say that and to be humbled by the amazingness of who we are. Not who we think we are, but who we actually are. It's something amazing that is not anyone's creation, because the soul is not created even. So it's something just to witness and marvel, and also honor and take care of. Again, so we were talking before, take care of your mental health, emotional health, physical health, but also learning to see ourselves in a dignifying way. Blessed Marshall used to use that term many times, like dignifying, dignified and dignifying. For me, humility, which is so crucial for us, also should be expressed in a way that is always dignifying. Because I've seen sometimes devotees thinking, expressing humility in ways that are traumatizing, actually. So, finding ways to practice bhakti, ways that are positive. I like always to reformulate also many of the things we express in positive ways, so we always have a positive version. Like, sometimes we want to speak about, I don't know, in some Gaudiya Vaishnava societies we have these four pillars of Dharma mentions in the Bhagavatam, sometimes translated as four regulative principles. I don't know how much in your Sangha that may be an aspect or not, because these different groups have different, but many times these are translated as do not eat meat, do not do that. So if someone asks you, okay, what's your practice about? And your reply is, I do not do this, I do not do that. So, but what do you do? So it's not, the practice is not do not eat meat. No, the actual pillar is ahimsa, which is non-violence, which goes beyond the plate to how to relate to everything. And it's still non-violence is expressed in the negative. No. So how, what will be a positive expression of do not be violent? Will we be kind, be caring, etc.? And not only that, but be as kind as you can. Because I also kind of like look for the lowest common denominator. Okay, what's the least kindness I can express at this moment? Be as kindness. So that's very different. Be as loving as you can from do not eat meat. Right? So one is very simplistic and negative. The other is very positive and very inviting. Be as kind as you can. I don't know how kind I can be actually. I like, oh, that invites me to explore my potential for kindness. So that sets me on a quest. Rather than don't eat meat, I'm already not eating meat. So I'm checking that box. I'm legal on the Ahimsa principle. Really? Be as kind as you can. Wow, that's a never-ending prospect. So for me, it's very important that each one of these ideas can be like reframed in ways that are positive and open-ended. So we do not conclude thinking, I'm already doing that. But we remain open, humbly open to continue growing and discovering. And one last thing.
We're not in a rush, Marge. You can have many more things.
Yeah, I always say one last thing and then I end up saying like 10 more. So it's my own self-deception here. No, but one last thing at least, let's see, but that comes in this connection is, for me, a balanced and healthy and non-toxic practice of Krishna consciousness, Radha Krishna consciousness, is also thinking about Srila Siddhar Maharshi will always repeat this line, students forever. So to remain in that humble space of never taking Krishna consciousness for granted. No? Even if we learn all the proper verses and know all the songs and know what to how to reply to every question or think, we know. Being careful not to bring closure to the conversation, but keeping the conversation open. Katayantas chamam nityam, Krishna says in the Gita. My devotees are perpetually talking about me, both high and taparashparam. They are enlightening one another. They find like, I heard that one favorite verse of your Gurudev, Srila Bhaktisundar Govinda Maharaj, from the 12th canto of the Bhagavad, speaks about Hari Katha, like Navam Navam Ruchiram, like it's always fresh, always new. Mana Mahotsavam is a festival for the mind. So the point is, yeah, no matter if someone is practicing after 1 year, 10, 30 years, 30 lifetimes, the more we get closer to the infinite, Srila Bhaktisundar Goswami Maharaj will say, you will prove there's no limit to progress. So I think it's healthy to keep a healthy dose of mystery always in our practice. Like, I never fully know what this is about. I can never fully capture this because it's ever evolving. It's ever fresh, ever new. Krishna himself sees himself in a pillar and it's like, who is that beautiful boy? He's like, he's continually rediscovering himself. Mahaprabhu is Krishna trying to explore his own heart, like Radha, and all that, and that has no end. So we are invited to keep that same like childlike spirit of wonder and discovery. So I think that makes for a very balanced Krishna consciousness, not one that is rigid, that always looks for closure and definitive answers and this like excessive sense of certainty. It's okay to have some certainty. Of course, we need some certainty, but it's good to also be able to sit with uncertainty and not knowing everything and being open to be surprised to the movements of love. Hiri bhagati premna swabhava kuti lavabet. Rupa Goswami says, Prem, divine love, moves in a zigzag way like a snake, which means zigzag means it's not straight line, it's not predictable. Will take you by surprise. If we already think we figured everything out, now nothing will take us by surprise. And then spiritual life becomes boring, predictable, and that's no longer spiritual life. That's again, as toxic Krishna consciousness is impossible, boring spiritual life, the two together are not good companions. One makes the other impossible. So I think it's a healthy challenge for all of us too. As time passes, as the spiritual honeymoon is over, how to continue bringing excitement and wonder and finding the flame of inspiration after 5, 10, 20, 30 years, and really remaining in that place of surprise and childlike spirit, which, by the way, recently I discovered there's, of course, this famous verse in the Bible, like, only those who are like children can enter the kingdom of God. But recently, speaking with one friend who is a Rig Veda scholar, he told me actually there's one verse in the Rig Veda that says exactly the same thing. He sent me the verses. So we are all invited to become not childish, but childlike students forever, remain in that open space. So anyhow, those are some thoughts about how to make our practice, going back to the beginning, as Vaishnavas, honoring Vishnu or honoring the God of sustainability and keeping the practice sustainable throughout short term, middle term, long term, eternity term. And of course, knowing that different things will happen in the journey. You know, it's not like it's just a straight line, direct to Golok, full of ecstasy and no ups and downs. No? The other day I was talking to a devotee and he told me, "Oh Maharaj, when I joined, I thought that I will be just floating in an ocean of bliss forever. That will be the it, right?" And after 1 week or something, he had to confront the shadow, so to say. And again, I think something for speaking about the balance practice is also being at peace with not being in balance all the time, right? That's part of the balance, knowing that there will be times where we are not that balanced. We will have cloudy days, so to say, stormy days, apocalyptic days. That's not the end of the story, it will be the height of the storm. But there are ups and downs, no? Especially if we are not yet in certain stages of development from Nishtha onward. As we know, Bhishmanath Chakravarti Thakur, he describes in Madhurya Kadambini, Anishtita Vajana Kriya, or unstable bhakti. And I always do the joke with the devotees, I'm starting, he makes six symptoms for unstable bhakti, right? Utsahamayi and all that. Like initial enthusiasm, again, honeymoon, then comes the ups and downs, the extremes, struggling with the senses, and I don't know, so many other things. And I go one by one and I ask the devotee, okay, is anyone of you familiar with that? And everyone's like, you know, like in the football stadium, everyone goes like doing the wave, you know, everyone's raising their hand. And each one, in one sense, is more embarrassing than the other one, right? Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur even gives examples that make the whole thing even more embarrassing. But also, he presents that as this a symptom of one being on the bhakti path. So as embarrassing as that sounds, it's a confirmation that you're on the path. So that in itself is glorious. So that for me is a way of bringing balance to the unbalance of those parts of the landscape when we feel like up and down, oscillating. At the beginning, maybe the oscillation is like this, then gradually the oscillation reduces. But he's depicting all that as a symptom of unstable bhakti, but it's bhakti. So it's in itself, we are already on the sacred path. So the instability is confirming that you are on the sacred path. So there's reason to celebrate that. In the midst of the chaos and the ups and downs and the whatever existential crisis one may be going, it's part of the journey. So I think that's also is an important balancing element. That there will be messiness, that there will be, again, as we talked the other day, Bhagavatam is telling so many stories of great personalities doing not so great things. Like normalizing, this may happen. If this happens to great personalities, probably will happen to you as well. Not to justify and look for that, but as you were saying the other day, I think we don't need to look pray for trouble, that will come. No, so things will come, and having an acceptance, not resignation, but acceptance of, okay, this part of my journey, what do I have to learn from this? That's all balancing. So acceptance, those days that I don't feel so balanced, not going on to a toxic guilt, shame trip, and just bringing a whip and start to like to chastise myself. I must be doing something wrong. I'm sure I did some apparatus. That must be my fault. And we start, the more we go, that is like a downward spiral that rather than redeeming us, is pulling us darker and darker. So trying to accept, trying to be introspective, but also trying to take responsibility for ourselves, but trying to honor the stages of the journey. I cannot be, sometimes the woods get frustrated because they are expecting a certain fruit that will come, but maybe will come when you're an Asakti or Bhava Bhakti, and they're probably in an Arthani, Vritti, Bhajan, Kriya, so they're, I don't know, reading what Sanatana Goswami is feeling while chanting the name, and they are expecting that to happen. And that's not what should be happening to you now. What should be happening to us now probably is the ups and downs that Vishwana Chakravarti Thakur describes in Anishtita Bhajana Kriya. And we have to accept that as part of the process. It's also a gift. And go through that, and so on and so forth. So, yeah. For me, balance is a lot about that. Like, not so much like waiting for the ideal situation or waiting for something to happen, but learning to accept and embrace what is already coming, and working with that, and from that growing. Because if we wait for the ideal situation, find a good sofa like this one, because you will have to be waiting forever. So, a few words, I don't know if that helps, but I hope so. I don't know if some of you have anything to, you'd like to add on that. Again, there's no final word in this, it's an ongoing exploration. So.
How about being courageous to kind of break through old patterns and what we know already and what is comfortable in our little bubbles, and we know that we can grow and just not living in the past.
That's my answer to that. It's totally necessary. It's like Srila Samaraj will say, die to live. So that will be dying to a version of ourselves, to a version of seeing things, to a version of understanding Krishna consciousness that may have helped us on a part of the journey, and now it has a shelf life. No? It's not that it's bad, just we have outgrown that version. And now we are ready for the more spacious, deeper version, but that implies some releasing of toxic nostalgia. Oh, things used to be like this and like that. And it's like if I go to my mom, I give the example at times, and I say, Mom, it was so nice the time when I was a baby and you were changing my diapers. I would think about returning to that chapter. And my mom would be like, it was beautiful, but we are not going there. Because it was beautiful, we are ready for something more now. No? Everything's supposed, it was beautiful as it was there. Just an example, sometimes we insist on going back to the diaper chapter in Bhakti, so to say, and you have outgrown your diapers, so to say. Like if my mom, I don't know, she gave me a t-shirt when I was this size, and she now brings the t-shirt and says, okay, put this t-shirt, it's like, I put my hand there, I haven't grown the t-shirts. If I try, I will may get suffocated or something. So sometimes we try to do that in spirituality. We have like a t-shirt or like a pattern or like a vessel, a framework, a way of understanding things that it's already too small. It's not that it was bad, it was perfect for that chapter. now you're ready for the biggest, bigger chapter, the bigger teacher, the bigger whatever. But that's a form of dying to a version of ourselves, dying to a version of Krishna consciousness, and being born again, and dying again, and being born again. It's an ongoing series of deaths and rebirths. That's how you can describe the journey. Ongoing dying and live, die to live, die to. It's not you die once and live once. It's an ongoing. Every time Krishna plays the flute, inviting the gopis for Rasa Lila in eternity, they have to die. They have to surrender themselves on a new level. They're fully surrendered, but still they can always keep surrender. So they die to the previous form of surrender to discover a new level of surrender and be born to that new version of themselves in love of Krishna. That's happening even in the spiritual world. So it's an ongoing thing. So here we are training ourselves for that. So yeah, that's kind of what I meant before with coexisting with some degree of uncertainty, because it can feel scary. Because again, certainty gives us like, okay, I know who I am, what this is, how to think, and going beyond the comfort zone is like, ooh, what's there? But it's necessary. Yeah. I always like to think about the Brahma Vimohan Lila in the Bhagavatam, which is like for me a very important Lila for many reasons. And then the prayers of Brahma after that, very important, very beautiful. But regarding what you just said, Bhakti Lalita is very illustrative, because Brahma Vimohan Lila, before that, Brahma of course meets Krishna at the beginning of creation. He meets a version of Krishna, Krishna speaking to Krishna, to Brahma more like a guru, in a very Upanishadic way, showing Gyan Mudra, like with some formality. And Brahma is receiving instructions at the beginning of creation. But at one point about and say, Brahma and Krishna shake hands. And Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments, at that moment Brahma receives some attraction towards, relate to Krishna as a friend. You say, oh, this handshaking feels nice. It's nice to hold hands with Krishna. So it says that he develops some thirst for, oh, Sakya Rasa. But still he had some image of Krishna, more like formal guru, like instructing. So eventually, we know the Brahma Mohan Lila, Brahma goes to see what's going on in Vrindavan after Agasura was killed and so on. And he sees Krishna, but he sees a very different Krishna. The same, but very different mood than the one he saw at the beginning of creation, instructing him, Chaturshloki of the Bhagavad. Now he's having a picnic, right? So the universal teacher of the cosmos now is having a picnic, and his friends are tasting their own lunchbox and giving Krishna their remnants, right? Like again, completely breaking all Brahma's previous version of Krishna. Like Brahma at the beginning didn't understand, and he thought, this is an imposter. This cannot be Krishna, because the Krishna I knew was like this. But now he was ready to have his understanding updated. But in the beginning, as we know, he tried to show the imposter Krishna, and then he realized, okay, what's going on here? And eventually he accepted, as we know. And he had a glimpse of what Sakya Rasa is about, right? Because he said, oh, I like this handshaking, but he didn't understand the full implications of what it means to be an equal with God as a friend. And when he saw that for a moment, he was bewildered. It was too much for him. And gradually he understood. Some acharyas will even say that eventually he came as Haridas Thakur and Gaur Lila, and then he received the final touch of grace required to attain his desired goal. But my point is that, yeah, the Lila is very illustrative in this sense, that Brahma had a fixed idea of who Krishna is. And then when Krishna appeared in a deeper way, we will say in our tradition, bring down with his friends, he could not recognize it. Bhakti Rakakshya Goswami Maharaj says something beautiful in the same way in Triguru and His Grace. He says, Indra, he lives in the heavenly planet with Upendra. No? Bhaman Devis is an expression of Bhaman Devis with Indra Lok. Upendra is a name for Bhaman, who means he's a brother of Indra. So Indra is accustomed to live with Bhaman Dev, who is God, let's put it that way. But when God appeared, not as Brahmadev, but in his most confidential form as Krishna, Indra couldn't recognize that. He attacked it. Srila Senma is saying that in the context that sometimes we have an idea of Guru or Guru Tattva, and if we get too attached to that, when Guru, Sri Guru, the principle of Sri Guru manifests in a deeper way, if we are too attached with nostalgia to this only this version, we will not only not understand the deeper version, but we may even attack it. I think that's a deviation, that was never. So that's a very important point that we all need to be trained in. And we may fail sometimes and attack something that I was actually was deeper. But yeah, I think it's very important to at least be willing to go through that and not get too much like there's only one way of thinking about Krishna. There's only one. That's one of the main reasons I wrote my third book, which is basically all about Krishna's always becoming more Krishna, more beautiful, more deep. So we have to keep the pace of the sweet absolutes unfolding. Because if we put him in a box and say, oh, this is Krishna, that's what Brahmas did. Yeah, I met Krishna, the beginning of creation, this is Krishna. And then his four heads were spinning like crazy when he thought this is Krishna. And Krishna showed himself a deeper version of that, right? So, yeah, it's very humbling. Because we have to remain in a space of always learning the whole thing anew. No? That's the symptom of prem, sneha, mam, pranaya, raga, anurag. Anurag means that at every moment Radha and Krishna meet, they feel they are meeting for the first time. That's very interesting. It's literally, maybe they were united and they are separating after the union, and as they are separating, Radha looks back and says, who is, she asks Lalita or something, who is that beautiful blue sapphire boy? I never seen him. And Lalita said, you have just been with him, that's Krishna. No, he's something else is going on, he's someone else. She's, because Krishna already is new, he reached a new level of blooming.
Fresh.
Ever fresh, Navayopana, right? And the same from Krishna's side toward Radha. So everything is blossoming anew. So nobody's taking for granted anything or anyone. Everyone keeps like, wow. But that implies releasing the previous version to discover the new one. Nobody's like, this is Krishna, only can be Krishna. So that's the price for us to enter that realm. And everything is keeps updating itself constantly. We need, it's like with the cell phone, right? If you do not update the app, the whole thing becomes non-operative. So you need like go and update for things to keep flowing. I mean, yeah, and I'm never using the word easy here. Sometimes it can be hard, because it can be hard even to realize, oh, I have fixed ideas. I'm rigid. I'm like narrow-minded. Or I'm afraid of exploring what's beyond my certainty. I still want to control, basically. Because if I put Krishna in a box, Guru in a box, it's a tendency to control. Maya. Maya means that which can be controlled. It means illusion also. It's not possible to do that. So.
Sometimes we might have to let go of those who are holding us back, and don't approve of moving forward in like uncharted territory, uncertainty,
and
toxic association,
sometimes again that can be inside of ourselves also, those voices. Sometimes they can be outside. Whatever they come, I think it's important. Yeah, healthy association should be always pushing us to explore and to grow.
And we might outgrow certain level of association.
Yeah. And again, I wouldn't say it's because I'm better and we start to feel superiority complex or to criticize the other ones. because maybe for that, that's for them, that's perfect and that's what they need. But if I need something else, for whatever reason, again, not putting me above anyone, I need to follow my call, right? And sometimes, yep, that may mean releasing a relationship or a community or even a guru sometimes. Again, that's a more complex situation, but well, I have a little experience in that arena. And again, not saying that one is better than anything, but just if you feel some particular connection is cutting my wings, as we all say in Argentina, it's not allowing me to fly as I know I can and I need, I need to break free from that. I need to keep honoring my Satyam Param Dhimahi, my call for the truth. No? So Sri Siamar speaks so beautifully in Sri Guru and His Grace about that. Like, sometimes some people may be with you, some soldiers may fall in the war and you may need to continue alone, and sometimes you will find yourself accompanied, but sometimes the ideal company may not be there, and your thirst for the truth, your sincerity is invincible, that will be your guide. So yeah. Some of those may be complex times also, because it's confusing, like what to do here, maybe painful. Sometimes you may have been with certain people for a long time, but also you feel there's a call that is pushing me somewhere, and I, at least for me, I will say I cannot betray myself. If you clearly know I'm being called somewhere and I do not do that, I won't be at peace with my pillow at night, so to say. And it will be complex. But, yeah. And there are so many examples of great personalities for doing that, or becoming great personalities because of doing that.
Remember who it is, one example, it's Narottam Thakur wanting the association of Ramachandra Kaviraj.
Mm-hmm.
It's in one of the songs. When will my guru put me in the hand of this Vaishnava?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And respectfully, prayerfully, not like renouncing their guru, but
yeah,
when will you pass me to this great personality,
Ramachandra. And it's beautiful also the example, because Ramachandra Kaviraj is actually a, like age-wise, that's like Sri Krishna Chaitanya. That's his own idea, Ramachandra Kaviraj.
Yeah.
And Ramachandra is, it's actually a, age-wise, it's a peer of Narottam Das.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting also that he's longing to have that association with a peer that he may feel, of course, probably is superior or not, but longing for a particular type of sangha, which not necessarily is like an elder or a guru relationship, but maybe more like a brother friendship, fellowship that can be as nourishing, right? So for me, that's also a very unique way in which guru tattva can manifest. Elders, of course, but peers, I mean, even juniors, you can learn from everyone at the end of the day. Bhagavatam, when it gives the 24 gurus, 21 are element of nature, 3 human beings, 1 baby, 1 girl, 1 prostitute, just to make the case that in principle, guru is everywhere. But yeah, I agree with your point. Sometimes we, as Rupa Goswami says, sadhu sangha should be swajatiya, snigda, and swatavara. Like, it has to be like-minded. And at one point, yeah, you may find some need for being in certain language and certain mood. And I'm not talking here necessarily about being aligned with the same rasa or something. It could be also a way of practicing and living, and that's not limited, in my view, to any one group or the other. It's whatever it is, go for that. That's the famous verse, Krishna Bhakti Rasa Bhavitamati Kriyatam Yadi Kutopi Labhyate Tatra Laulyam Apyekalam Molyam Janmakoti Sukritam Labhyate. whenever you find that essence of Krishna Bhakti, you have to have the greediness for that, and it doesn't matter from where it's coming from. Basically, that's it. If you are greedy for something, you won't be too picky. I don't know, I'm greedy, but if it's not coming from this certain, then you are not that greedy. If you are greedy, you may not care if it's this person, is man, woman, Indian, Western, this group, that group, if it's genuine connection. That's at least personally how I try to live my own Krishna consciousness. I don't care if someone says, oh, you're connected to this person, but he's from this mission, not from this mission. I don't care. I'm not seeing the person in terms of a mission. I'm relating to the person. Oh, but he's not a Gaudiya Vaishnava. He's a Christian mystic. I don't care. Sometimes I'm closer with some Christian mystic, I'm closer than with some Gaudiya Vaishnava. In terms of, maybe theologically we may differ on some things, but in terms of the spirit through which to live our life, many times I find myself closer to some people from sister traditions than from my own traditions, which is an interesting paradox. So, yeah.
Still, you remain rooted in Gaudiya Vaishnava.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hope so. But at the same time, yeah, I am. I don't think there is a reason not to be learning from other wisdom schools and mystics. I would say Gaudiya Vaishnava is my main meal, and I have my vitamin supplements from different traditions. I don't want to be a Gaudiya Vaishnava to the point of not being able to learn and commune and connect with sister traditions. If that's the price to be a Gaudiya Vaishnava, then I'm not a Gaudiya Vaishnava. But I know that Gaudiya Vaishnavism is not that. Gaudiya Vaishnavism in itself, remember that one happened, and we may go into another topic. Following so well, a little bit. Once I was given a lecture, and sometimes my lectures and in my books I may refer to mystical Christianity or to Buddhism or to Sufism. Doesn't mean that I'm aligned with everything they say, but they can say something that I can appreciate it. Or sometimes I invite people to my podcast, and sometimes they both say, but Maharaj, that person thinks that I invite someone doesn't mean that I agree with that person on everything. If the prerequisite to engage in a conversation is agreeing on everything, probably you will never have any conversation with anyone because we disagree on something always. So I for me it's nourishing to sit with people I know I disagree with and learn to love themselves while disagreeing. Because if I just talk to someone and we agree on everything, it's nice, but it can get a little boring. And Gaudiya Vaishnava is my point that I was going to say. Once one devotee told me, Maharaj, why you are not on, why in your classes you do not only quote orthodox Gaudiya Vaishnava authors? And I was like, okay. I could do that, no problem, but the point is, and I asked him, I wanted to make a point to him. So, okay, what's orthodox Gaudiya Vaishnava authors in Europe? He'll say, well, Rupa Goswami. Okay, we are Rupanugas, you cannot get more Gaudiya than that. Okay, which is Rupa Goswami's main book? Or most well known, I don't want to put hierarchy, but Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu probably most will say. Okay, so Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is a whole treatise in which Rupa Goswami speaks about Krishna as Rasa. And the whole book is about Rasa, Bhakti, Rasa, Amrita Sindhu. And the whole structure of the book is borrowed from Bharat Muni's Natya Shastra, which is a secular book on Indian aesthetics. Right? Just to be historically accurate. And I'm not saying that's bad or it's a problem. I'm just saying Rupa Goswami took that structure. Of course, he made adjustments and presented the idea of Bhakti Rasa, which is genius-like, but still he's taking from other tradition, which is not even a spiritual one, secular aesthetics, and he's using that in his main book. So our orthodox Gaudiya Vaishnava author, he's drawing from other sources. So that's Orthodox Gaudiya Vaishnavism. Jiva Goswami, you cannot get more orthodox than that. If you study his Sandarbhas, he's making Gaudiya points, but he's referring to other authors from other. He's quoting Shankaracharya at times, not even to refute him, but to support his points. I mean, he's quoting Madhvacharya, he's quoting Ramanuja. Those are other traditions. And he's bringing all of them in his main Gaudiya Vaishnav ontology of theology called Satsandarbha. So our main Gaudiya books are including other thinkers from other schools. So for me, that's how, when I say, yeah, I'm rooted in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but Gaudiya Vaishnavism also is including, or in itself already, the influx of other currents, and it should continue to do so, in my opinion. Without compromising, of course, the core teachings. I'm not saying here, let's make a hodgepodge, it's all the same, no. But also, it's not, we are not that different, entirely different, because sometimes we can get a little bit insular, and that's not healthy for me also. And we can only speak from our own point of reference with our own lingo about our own tradition. It can get a little bit like too self-referential, and we don't then know how to speak with anyone else.
And it's not good for our own growth.
Yeah.
We can just suffocate ourselves.
Yeah. We can become cultish and fanatics. And and not even with other tradition, but even with other. For me, again, I'm talking for myself, I'm not here giving any prescription for anyone how to live their lives. But there are so many ways of practicing Gaudiya Vaishnavism also. And of course, one will have their one's own favorite way or mood or way of speaking, and it's beautiful. But it's, I think it's healthy also to know about other ways, even if there may not be my cup of tea. Still, those who are bona fide, so to say, learn to acknowledge that diversity and even engage in conversation with that. We find contrasts and differences, but for me, again, I'm someone who really gets nourished in diversity, and I know not everyone is like that, so I'm not here expecting everyone to do the same. That would be narcissism, but to some degree I think that's healthy for everyone. In some stage of the journey, I understand that in the beginning, one may be a little bit more sectarian and fanatical, and so to say, or just learning one's tradition. Okay, I'm becoming Gaudiya Vaishnava, what this is about. I may not have time to go and make connections with Christian mysticism, and this first I need to know what I'm doing. And then when I'm rooted there, I can extend to others without losing myself in that, right? Swami Maharaj Prabhupada gave this nice example, like this similar example to the Bhakti Lata Beach, like the vine of devotions. In the beginning, we have this seed, and there's the first tiny, tender, like bud, and it's still very fragile, and it can be affected by the environment. So we'll put some fence, like this. The bud is here, and the fence goes still here. So in the beginning, you just grow and you don't see anything. You're not capable of being nourished by the diversity outside. It will be overwhelming. So you're growing in your own little box. But you're growing up and down. You're getting rooted, learning your tradition. And and he will say, when you grow enough, you are rooted enough, you also will be growing naturally beyond the fences. And then you can see what's out. Oh, there's a whole new world of diversity. But that's no longer threatening because you're rooted enough. So that's, I think, it's a nice analogy of the need for those fences and for that narrow-mindedness in the beginning, if you want. Necessary one. But at one point, necessary also to outgrow the fence, so to say. Because if not, we can become dangerous people, cultish fanatics. And you just take a look at the history of humanity and what we have done in the name of religion. And so, I think it's important to grow from that place, from at one stage, And that was not something of the past, but even now, people will kill each other if you are from different, from another tradition. I mean, if you do not convert to mine, you are dead. So that was at one time, but also I will say there's people nowadays who think like that. Maybe they cannot do it because they go to jail, or they do it and they go to jail. So that's one totally primitive level. Like, this is the only thing. Then came this term in the 60s, I think, religious tolerance, which still is awkward, no? Like, okay, I tolerate you. Okay, you're from another tradition. I've learned to tolerate you. I won't kill you. It's like, okay, thank you. So, okay, it's a progress from killing each other. Okay, we learn, somehow manage to tolerate each other. But still we need to grow beyond that, right? And then we may have something like, I don't know, interfaith dialogue between different traditions, or intrafaith dialogue between the same tradition but different branches of it. But sometimes that's also more, many times, like a passive appreciation of the doctrine of every tradition. I've been in some of those, and sometimes they tend to get a little bit like, how to say, protocolar. You say like, hey, we meet, hello, so my tradition is about the, okay, good, that's right. It's great, we are not killing each other, we are not thinking I have to tolerate you, but still there may not be so much like an openness to be transformed by the other. It's more like a passive appreciation from my safe nest. Great, it's part of the journey, but for me, ideally, it has to reach the point when I meet someone and I'm both are open and are transformed by each other's insights in a natural way, not in a way that is like crushing my faith or confusing me, but just adding another element, no? Like Uddha, no? Uddha is said to have this relationship with Krishna in a certain mode, but when he goes to Vrindavan, he receives a particular samskar, impressions that add to his mood, no? So, or Gopakumar's in the Brihadbhagavatamrita, right? Gopakumar is traveling, and he has his goal is Sakya Rasa in Vrindavan, but on his way he meets so many other devotees with different moods, and it's not like he's saying, oh, I don't want to talk to you, I will get my Sakya Bhav contaminated, I don't want to dilute my... Somehow he's incorporating their own gifts and combining them in a tasteful way to his own aspiration for Sakya Bhav. I would say when he meets with Hanuman, and Gopakumar asks Hanuman, like, please chant the glories of Ram. No, he's not asking Hanuman, you have to chant the glories of Krishna in Vrindavan as a friend. And he's not a religious fanatic. he knows your Ishtadev, your Prabhu is Ramachand. Sing the glories of Ram. So Hanuman starts. And then Gopakumar, at the end, he says, Jai Sri Krishna. In other words, he knows we are talking about the same person, Ram Krishna. You have your own mood. And when I witness your love for Ram, my love for Krishna gets increased.
That's beautiful. Example.
That's the perfection of interfaith dialogue. If I see you as a genuine Christian and you talk to me about your love for Jesus, my love for Mahaprabhu will increase. And for Jesus as well. And then after that, it was the other way around. When Hanuman ended, he said to Gopakumar, please chant the glories of Krishna in Vrindavan. So Gopakumar started to sing different names of Krishna in Vrindavan, and then Hanuman said, Jai Sri Ram. His faith in the Brahma was nourished. No? So that's for me the ideal way of, nobody's trying to convince, to convert. Everyone is expressing their heart and faith, and that's naturally nourishing for everyone in their way. In the same way, if I meet you and I say, okay, please sing the glories of your guru, that will nourish the faith of my faith in my own gurus, so to say. And it's not like so much, I will try to convince you that my guru is the best and you have to come to me and leave that person you have faith in. But because at the end of the day, guru is one. Guru Tattva, Bhagavan is one. So. There's that quote of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said, right? If you go to, I shared that in my second book, if you enter a mosque or a church or some temple different from your traditions, like, you should think, oh, how beautiful and interesting how they are worshiping my Krishna here. And by me witnessing this, my own love for Krishna will increase. And then he, I don't remember the exact word, but he says, he uses heavy words, those who do not think like that. He starts like, are useless or like, are dangerous or like, to prevent us from being like sectarian and animal minded. Yeah. Okay. You did it.
This is for you.
I want to squish like a lemon. I think you can get some happiness.
Oh, of course, so. I love to be squeezed.
You like to be squeezed.
Because I don't feel I'm being squeezed at the end of the day. It's mutual, right? It's nourishing. Yeah.
We're mining, not squeezing.
Yeah. And it's always mutual. Again, I never feel like, okay, I'm the one enlightening or sharing. It's back and forth. Even if I'm the one opening my mouth the most in some cases, I mean, just witnessing you present, listening, opening, I mean, seeing your faces, things happen while you're here, and so that's also a feedback for me in silence. So it's ongoing conversation. The one is the only one doing this part.
Like Ramananda Sambhava, it's like the ocean, the cloud, and the cloud gives the Gita, also in our Gita is there that you need calf in order to the cow gives milk.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
The cow.
Hey, well, how's the verse?
In the Mangalacharna.
Yeah. I know that, but I forgot it now.
I don't remember.
The Bhakti. How Krishna knows something with the Bhakti thing there?
Yeah.
Dukta Gopala Nandana.
Yeah.
Partha Bhatsa Sudhir Bhokta. Anyhow.
Gitam Gitam Ritam
Mahat. Yeah, but we are forgetting the first line. Mm-hmm. Anyhow,
something
with Upanishad, something with Upanishad. Sarva Upanishad Ogavo. That's the first line. Sarva Upanishad Ogavo. Bhagavad Gita is the essence of all the Upanishads. Yeah.
So I think in there was some necessity of this kind of kata. Actually, I told already, Lalita, when I listen to your talk about this balance from tradition and innovation, and this and that, I agree 90%. I was already in my lab going on those things. And yeah, today, something that I heard that was very much necessary to hear.
Yeah, and that's the essence of tradition. That day I was in the Netherlands. We had a meeting within a Franciscan monastery. I was talking with a Franciscan brother, Brother Theo. So it was very nice back and forth. And at the end I was talking with one of the monks there, and we were talking about tradition, because sometimes we think tradition means traditional, and traditional means always the same. Somehow we relate in that way. But I never knew that, and I love etymology, and he said, do you know what's the meaning of tradition? Etymologically, tradition basically means like handing over and like passing through, like an ongoing conversation that's like parampara, basically. One after another, so there's always something new passing to the other.
Parampara, but Sikh Shabbat.
Like
Guru Maharaj.
So of course we...
It's not institution, I think.
No, of course not. It should have a value, but it's just like the glass to convey the water, right? I mean, sometimes the glass breaks, I need to get a new glass to give the water, but sometimes I may not even need a glass, I can go... But we shouldn't stay one for the other. For me, the problem is institutionalism. institutions can't help. Sometimes eventually they collapse, they need to die, be reborn again, like all cycles in nature. But institutionalism, that's another thing. That's not good.
our Supreme Guru, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, wrote an article about institution.
Mm-hmm.
Very heavy.
Yeah.
Until it's conducive to develop bhakti in people,
mm-hmm.
it's good.
Yeah.
But when it's not,
you're
showing some distraction,
yeah.
I mean, some demolishing mode.
Yeah. When he built this Bhagavasar Gaudiya mat of marble, eventually the devotees were starting to leave there and to fight for in which room they will stay. They wanted kind of the more fancy room. He became like, and entered Simha mode and said, I will sell all the marbles and print books or something else. But the purpose of this thing was not for you to be fighting for comfort or whatever. It's not about the building, right? The marble is just to make a point and take the attention in some direction, but then many times institutions actually need to die.
Yeah, they,
I mean, that's a cycle, like we've seen Gaudiya Mat and this and that. And even if some institutions continue officially, they go through so many like deaths and rebirths. I'm not celebrating that, but at the same time I'm normalizing that, because that's necessary many times.
I always try to follow the red thread.
The golden thread.
Mm-hmm. The golden thread.
Yeah.
Like Ridayena Vigyato, the
mm-hmm.
correspondence of my heart.
Yeah.
It must be there, otherwise what we are talking about.
And it goes again back to Siksha Parampara. It may take different like zigzag movement. It may not be like always here or always there.
Exactly.
I like to say Krishna every night he won't play the flute from the same exact place in Vrindavan. So like, okay, tomorrow we'll find him at that time. He may be any other place and you have to learn where to follow the flute call, and it may be here and then there and there and there, in the same way our journey. I mean, I'm talking, just thinking for myself, that I start my journey in a certain way, thinking, okay, this is my line, my family, spiritual family, I will be doing this, living in this particular farm in Argentina. I basically was like, yeah, dying here. I'm just, and then again, the flute call started to sound in many other, stop sounding in some place, it started sounding somewhere else. So, as long as we keep following the flute call, that's the important thing.
Maybe also possible that Krishna choose some other devotees to kind of preserve some situation as they are,
mm-hmm.
which is also some meaning to exist. For example, in Jagannath temple,
mm-hmm.
Mahaprabhu never tried to criticize,
challenge the rules,
the Pandava,
mm-hmm.
the Pandas.
Yeah.
But they we cannot say they are practicing Krishna consciousness,
mm-hmm.
like Mahaprabhu's line.
Mm-hmm.
They are different vision,
yeah.
But still they are serving
yeah.
Jagannath in this way.
Mm-hmm.
So must be some recognition of some group that Krishna use to go on with some kind of settlement that is conducive. Or some kind of
mm-hmm.
presentation
yeah.
can be conducive
yeah.
for some kind of people. I also personally come from Catholic tradition, and I don't feel any more nourishment in that department, unless Gurudev said, oh, in the Salomon song you can trace Madhura Rasa.
Mm.
Then from my guru I can
mm-hmm.
understand. But I can see Christian tradition or Buddhist tradition in Thailand, they give some basis for people, some good inspiration, some ABC of being aware of the law, at least.
I personally wouldn't only limit that to an ABC, but I understand the point. I'm personally more of like, okay, someone can achieve an eternal realm through Christianity, for
example.
May be a different realm that we are thinking, but I wouldn't just say like, of course there are ABC levels of Christianity, but then you go like to some deep mystics and people who have very intense revelations, like, okay, that's something. And the same we can find our tradition, right? It's very deep and detailed, but we can find people practicing from a very ABC level, and there's place for everyone in the alphabet.
Mm-hmm. You have to have the capacity to recognize devotion in outcoming.
Like Mahaprabhu, right, traveling in South India, and he's meeting the roots of Ramachandra or other, visiting Shiva temple. As you say, he's not like disrupting the order. Hey, you have to all become Gaudiya Vaishnavas. Or actually, when he meets this devotees of Ram, he's not saying, hey, come to Madhurya Rasa, he's trying to nourish the faith of that devotee who was thinking Sita was kidnapped by Ravana, and he was crying, and Mahaprabhu got this verse and tried to prove, no, she was not kidnapped. So there's, I like that, sections like that that also show, we may have some particular affinity. I like to say it that way for me, and Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami says that nicely in Chaitanya Charitamrita. He says every devotee feels their connection with their own connection with God is the best, and everyone is correct. No? So he's not saying, and only Gaudiya Vaishnavas are correct, or we are the highest.
Yeah, but still from neutral, like Tadashta Vichar, from neutral point of view, we can understand there is something lower and something higher. And the Bhagavatam begins with how the Kaitava religion is not our...
No, but in the context of genuine Dharma, there are many things that are all bona fide. I wouldn't say, for example, if I'm talking to a Sri Vaishnava, I wouldn't say my religion is higher than yours, right? Because you can be a Sri Vaishnava and reach Vaikuntha. So I don't feel the need to think that my religion is better than anyone else's. It's better for me. That's how I say. I'm not saying everyone has to think like
that. Our religion is Jiva Dharma. So Jiva Dharma is really universal, isn't it?
Yeah. Jiva Dharma is a general, it's a little bit, it's like Sanatan Dharma, it can be other people may use the same expression from their own place, but I get the point.
I think the problem is, see, we have to grow up, basically.
Sorry?
We have to grow up.
Grow up.
We need to grow.
Yeah.
As, from childish, becoming teenager, babies, trying to be adult. Spiritually speaking. And the disappearance of the guru is a very crucial point. I mean, we are leaving this phase. We are nourished like little puppies by Gurudev. Gurudev disappear, in his lila disappear from our vision. So now we have to live with his teachings.
Yeah. And also I'm thinking, like we were talking yesterday, no? Like when Krishna disappeared from the gopis start to see Krishna everywhere. So sometimes, it sounds easy, of course, in practice it's complex, but guru disappears from our vision. Okay, how to find guru everywhere now?
Yeah.
In separation, right? Union separation.
Well, Gurudev, he tried to teach Paramahamsa Dharma, but it's not easy for the students to be Paramahamsa.
For the non-Paramahamsa, it's difficult to be Paramahamsa.
Exactly. So it's, we have to be a little careful. No? We think now I can get the milk everywhere. But I'm talking
for
myself.
Yeah. Oh, some discernment always is, especially as you say, when we are not on the Paramahamsa level, that just naturally you're seeing essence everywhere. Right? Yeah.
But still, this is the inspiration.
To become a swan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Swan like, not us like.
Swan like. Parrot like Sukadeva.
Yeah.
I always like to say, which parrot you want to be, because also you can be a parrot which has parrots.
Just repeat.
Copy paste.
Copy paste.
The Bhagavatam gives the other parrot example that always is like adding something new. Speaking about the tradition and contribution to the tradition. Okay, I received all this. What's my contribution to the parampara?
Yeah.
It's not like, not only my guru and his guru make contribution and to fall into make contribution. Well, they expect you to make contribution because we are all part of the parampara, right? Of course, we may need first to grow, as you say, and be settled and everything. But like, you cannot ask a two-year-old boy, what's your contribution to our family line? The boy is still being fed and chained, but eventually when it's a grown-up, it's like, yeah, enrich our ancestors, so to say, like contribute something.
Yeah,
we are having some flute call over there.
Mi risultò molto difficile questa parte, che volevo quasi spiegare come razzismo, razza, no? Mm-hmm. Dice, però come è che se mi religione è meglio perché io so tutti i dettagli che Krishna che hace in Vrindavana,
mm-hmm.
e come si chiama lo zarcillo, come si chiama il collar,
mm-hmm.
tutto suo amico, tutti i momenti. Tanta información, ¿no?
Uh-huh.
Mientras que puedo ver un cristiano que no sabe todos esos detalles, así que mi religión es superior
uh-huh.
a la de ellos, ¿no? Pero aquí se trata de una historia de amor, no se necesitan, ellos no necesitan todos esos detalles
uh-huh.
que al final y al cabo pueden hasta desviarme de lo que es realmente esta historia de amor.
Uh-huh.
Y hay algo muy peculiar que al final del libro de Gopakumara, que te explica toda esta parte de Gopakumara, cuando él va donde Shiva nos dice, vamos para Vrindavana porque es mejor, él se queda ahí honrando ¿no? su relación con Krishna, ¿no? etc. Pero al final, cuando, no me acuerdo si es él o el nombre, no me acuerdo, Radharani le dice a él, cuando vuelves para Mathura, creo que, le dice, vaya a visitar este sadhu que se queda en tal sitio y dígale que yo lo aprecio, que yo siempre oigo sus oraciones, etc. Pero la peculiaridad de esta historia es que él era un devoto de la Dea Kali, no de Radharani.
Uh-huh.
Y Radharani le dice, vaya y dígale que,
uh-huh.
¿no? O sea, hay muchos niveles de
uh-huh.
entendimiento, todas esas cosas, va mucho más allá de esto,
uh-huh.
esto. Ahorita, si quiere, un poquito
de traducir
sí.
todo
eso. Sí, porque si no, no van a entender.
You want me to translate all of that now.
Y para mí es mucho difícil este racismo. ¿No?
Yeah, he's using a play of words that I made in my first book, which is racism, but sometimes not racism. Racism. Sometimes
racism.
We become racist in the context of rasa.
Racism.
No, my rasa is the best and all the others are below. And he was expressing that he always had some conflict with devotees expressing themselves with some type of superiority complex or sometimes thinking. We know the names of Radharani's ankle bell and nobody else knows that.
What we
know. So, no, right? And the Christian do not know that God has his father's name is this and the flute, he has these varieties of, so that can create also a toxic sense of certainty also. We have all the details, but we may not be too much okay with the mystery, and maybe some Christian mystic may have lots of love and do not need all the detail, but the love is there, And then he referred to Gopakumar, to the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, which, by the way, it's interesting because it's, that book is very non-sectarian, very showing all this. Mm-hmm. That's the very first book of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, if we consider it starting from Mahaprabhu. The very first written was by Sanatana Goswami, Brihad Bhagavatamrita. So that sets a very interesting tone. And he's mentioning two things. One, that when Gopakumar is meeting all these devotees, Gopakumar appreciates them and continues his journey, but the other devotees stay where they are. Like, honor Gopakumar, but they feel, this is my place, it's my mood. So he's showing both possibilities and appreciating them. And the other thing that he mentioned, at the end, when Gopakumar arrives to Golok and eventually he's sent back to earth by Radharani, at one point Radha tells Gopakumar, by the way, when you go back to Mathura, visit this particular devotee and tell him that I always hear his prayers. And then Gopakumar goes, and actually this devotee was a worshipper of Kali, you say. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, another expression ultimately of Devi, the Radha. But he was making the point that Brihad Bhagavatamrita is bringing all these elements to create this broad-mindedness. Like, it's not just this one thing, only this devotion, this type of devotee, but and again, that's the first book of the Goswamis, so that sets kind of the tone what the Gaudiya Sampradaya is about, in terms of course there is a clear emphasis on Madhurya Rasa. I'm not denying any of that, but at the same time Mahaprabhu's movement is very deep but also very, very broad. Okay.
Yeah.
Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai. She paid to one ambulance to make all that, so I cancel stop talking. So that's it.
The kitchen is pretty small, so I had to.
No, totally. That's why I asked in the beginning how much time. She said,
I don't know if you already have those.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Thank you.